Hi, welcome to the Secret Best Friends Club podcast for January. What's tomorrow?
Tomorrow is the 18th.
All right. Hi, my name is Chris.
My name is Kyle.
And we are part of the Secret Best Friends Club. You two are also part of the Secret Best Friends Club, being that you're listening to this podcast right now. This is our second podcast. We are recording it on an iPhone in a bedroom, which is very exciting. It's very...
Tremendously.
It's very ad hoc. It'll be good. Trust me. We have one other podcast in the archive right now. If you search us on iTunes, you can actually subscribe, which is really cool and exciting. Search for Secret Best Friends Club. Our first episode was about game feel. Check it out. Today's episode is going to be about sports.
Sports. Yes. Sports. Universally beloved sports.
So this is kind of a weird subject because we both are not necessarily sports people. But I think it's interesting that way.
I would actually reverse that. I would say we are necessarily not sports people.
Yes, that's true.
Like, my experience with sports is a very oblique, glancing blow off the field of sports.
Yep.
Where, so, like, I like it when I am immersed in the moment and I'm jumping up and down and shouting the huzzah that you say.
Absolutely, yes.
With the sports that are happening.
You say huzzah!
Yeah. And I will say that those feelings are visceral and powerful and not to be denied.
Yep.
But I don't find myself going out of my way to encounter those feelings.
Yeah,
or
necessarily.
Like gain camaraderie with people who have.
Yeah. We are also surrounded by sports, being in Seattle.
Yes.
Right now, nearing the Super Bowl season. The Seattle Seahawks are a particular Seattle phenomenon. I have to respect the branding of the Seahawks a lot. I think that their whole like 12th man campaign is pretty brilliant.
It is.
For community building. And it surprisingly does not... I don't know. It doesn't annoy me. It makes me feel good about the community when I see lots of people wearing Seahawks stuff at the same time, and the 12th man flag hanging from the Space Needle and everything. I think that's really powerful stuff. But I do not partake in sports myself.
I'm glad that you have that reaction to it. It's a good narrative shift that I should try and undergo many times, because I have to admit that I do have an immediate response to Seahawks fervor.
Yeah.
And most of the time, it's not necessarily a positive response.
Yeah.
Well, even though I've watched the games and done the cheers.
It's relatively exciting. I grew up, my dad and stepmom were really into football and would have Super Bowl parties and everything. And I just never really liked it much. I mean,
yeah.
And probably both of us being kind of nerdy, slight.
Slight of build.
Slight of build.
Is the euphemism you're approaching here.
Potentially asthmatic.
Skinny as hell.
Yeah. We were not necessarily very strong, sporty people.
No.
Growing up, I did enjoy playing some sports. I enjoyed lacrosse.
Mm-hmm.
In high school, I thought that was fun. I played soccer in like fifth grade. Our team only won one game, and it was against the deaf school. There was a blind school and a deaf school in Vancouver, and we played the deaf school twice. And it was the second time we played them, we beat them, which was great because they were fighting the entire time.
Mm-hmm.
And that was unfortunate. But today we're going to talk about sports video games.
Yes.
Because sports video games tend to be an entirely different beast than the sport that they tend to represent.
Right. Necessarily so. I think we were just talking about Atari 2600 games, and that's where I think a lot of attempts at sport games originated, and the limitations of that system necessarily meant that you would not be able to have a simulation of sports, that you had to approximate like the feeling of playing the sports.
Well, most of the very first electronic games were sport-based, too. Pong is table tennis, that little... football game, that little, what was it, like, it wasn't Tiger Electronics, it was like Texas Instruments football. Those were the very first examples of games, because those analogs exist in culture already, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you know what football is, you can, it's not very much of a cognitive leap to imagine that dots moving up and down an electronic device represent football players.
Right, and you have this whole schema that you can hang your involvement on. Like, you understand the rules and the constraints of the game, and not as much has to be communicated to you by the graphics and sounds.
Right, and that's very important. And then, you know, contrast that to today, when we have a large vocabulary around video games, and you can do basically whatever you want. And so you have games that are directly representative of sports, like FIFA or Madden, you know, which do a very good job, and sometimes can even be predictive of actual sports.
Right.
You know, you can run simulations in Madden to try to predict who's going to win the Super Bowl pretty reasonably. And then there are other games like Rocket League,
yes,
which are pure joyous, like, tributes to the feeling of playing a sport.
Oh, I love Rocket League. I love it so much. I played it exactly one time.
Yeah.
But I played it for like 6 hours.
Yeah.
Like,
so for those who aren't familiar, Rocket League is a game for PC and PlayStation 4. I don't know if it's for Xbox. Next gen systems. And you are rocket powered cars on a soccer field, a futuristic soccer field with a giant soccer ball.
It's like a soccer dome.
Yeah.
You're playing soccer with cars in a soccer dome.
It feels like Blitzball in Final Fantasy X, if it were a good game.
Oh, it's so good.
Yeah. It's very fast-paced, very exciting, and just has this just visceral feeling of just kicking a ball really, really hard in somebody's face.
Yeah, I think that what I love most about Rocket League is that it has that Mario Kart kind of feel of press button to play the game.
Yeah.
Like, you can hold the button down and just kind of steer and think about where you want to go. And a lot of times your car, and the way that they handled the physics in the game, your car just does things that you want it to do. And if when it does things you don't want it to do, most of the time it just looks awesome.
Yeah.
I think a lot can be said about the camera work in that game. The camera work in that game is completely sublime, and they do an amazing job of picking really salient moments, crowd-ready moments, and presenting them to you. The game is constantly showing you replays and, like, slowing down in anticipation and speeding up, like when the ball bursts through the goal and explodes and knocks all the cars back. It's a very crowd conscious game.
Well, so much about like a really effective sports game, I think, is capturing those moments where like you're like, did you just see that? Like, it enables really accidental, fun, exciting moments like that.
Totally.
Like Smash Brothers is like that.
Absolutely.
Right, where it's a series of constraints and inputs that enable these very spectacular things to happen, even if you didn't intend them to.
Yeah, the peaks and valleys of Smash Brothers or Rocket League, they're presented to you over and over again. These games want to make sure that you saw it. They're like, did you just see what happened?
Yeah.
I'm going to show it to you again.
That was balls out, just bonkers.
Yep, that was ridiculous. It was ridiculous with a capital Iculus.
And like, you don't even have to be like a high level player to really have fun in those games either.
No, not at all.
You don't have to be effective necessarily. You can be.
Yes.
Right, there's gradations.
Yeah. I think that, I mean, the first time that I played that game, there was like a revolving door. It was at Fantastic Arcade, actually, I should say, that I was without a place to stay. I was like, Ian Snyder, my Versnoof partner, can you please like make sure that I have a place to sleep tonight? And I just threw myself upon his, and he was like, oh yeah, totally, because I am new here as well. And so we were just all casting about. We ended up staying in a house with a bunch of different people. It was Davey Reedon's house, and Robin Arnott was playing Rocket League and said, like, hey, do you want to play? And I was like, yes, I would like to. And then 6 hours later, we had gone from a band of people that were mashing buttons and shrieking to a band of people that were mashing buttons and shrieking in victory because we had intentionally done things that we wanted to do.
See, this is interesting because, like, so I feel like the indie game community, especially the ones around the Fantastic Arcade and, you know, people who show stuff at like Wild Rumpus every year, have gravitated towards a sports metaphor for most of their game design.
Yes.
You know, games like Nidhogg or Killer Queen or Push Me, Pull You. Mm-hmm. You know, these are games that are very much not necessarily competition-centric, but group play-centric.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Johann Sebastian Joust is another one that really hit hard in the indie scene and the festival scene a number of years ago, where it's just like, it's just about the purity of play with other people and the moment-to-moment kind of competition. Like, it's not even a direct competition. Like, it's... You could get better at it. You could be better than someone else, but it almost doesn't matter because you're all having fun anyway.
Yeah, I think it's exploring that that aspect of play that is performative, but performative in the sense that you're all like a group of people performing the experience of play for spectators. Mm-hmm. Like saying like, here, we're all like engaged in this like magic circle type game, like experience that we're all having together. But also we want to invite you into it as much as possible to watch it and to be with us in this moment.
Right.
And I think that this is just speaks of game culture in general right now, that there's a real recognition and understanding of the spectator as powerful.
Yeah.
And that spectating itself and watching games can be a powerful experience and participation in community, that you don't just have to be creating and making things to participate in games.
So, like, you actually made a version of Fjords that was a multiplayer version, Fjords Forever.
Yes, I'm still working on it, actually. I mean, I'm not actively working on it because I'm working on other things, but...
Right. But it's sitting there 90% complete at the progress bar on your computer, basically.
Yeah, basically. It's just, it's sitting there waiting for me to decide what I want it to look like when it's going to be done.
So I actually had the distinct pleasure of seeing this played at a Wild Rumpus party, right? Have you ever seen that game played?
No, I remain incomparably jealous, like, because I have an idea in my mind about how it should go.
Yeah.
But I've never seen anybody play it that doesn't already know what it is.
Yeah, so at Wild Rumpus one year, which is a really amazing party at GDC every year, with just... It's in this space that has these distinct little rooms, and it's a loud sort of nightclub setting on the floor. And, you know, you walk in and maybe like Phil Fish is, you know, spinning, or what's his name? Pete from Anamanaguchi, you know, spinning some video game inspired tracks. And then you just sort of explore the space and you go to different rooms, and there are different games there to play that are, you know, kind of competitive games. They're kind of group games. So that was my first exposure to the Winnetron and Nidog,
right?
To Keita Takahashi's Alphabet game, should I forget what it's called?
I refer to it as Pooping Alphabets.
Pooping Alphabets, yes.
Yes.
Rafflepiller, which is a game where you actually get into little
Rafflepiller is so good
sleeping bags of a sort, and you roll around under a little, I don't know, computer screen with somebody, and you're a caterpillar. It's bizarre stuff. And Push Me, Pull You, which we'll talk about in a second because I have to talk about that.
That game is in. Yes.
And then if you go upstairs in a small dark room, there was this sort of like ambient music and monochromatic colors being blasted onto people's face, and Fjords Forever with little icicle lights hanging down from the ceiling. And I walked into there and I'm like, oh, I know this game. Okay. sat down at a bench and just watched people discover this game with no context, and it was amazing. It was incredible. So in Fjords Forever, you're the little Fjords guy. If you haven't played Fjords yet, you should.
Just keep talking about it forever.
We'll just talk about it forever.
I mean, that's why it's called Fjords Forever. It's so I can continue to talk about myself forever.
So it's kind of like you've got a grappling hook, and the other guy's got a grappling hook, and you're just sort of grappling around a space, and there's some interesting physics, and you're kind of, you know, swirling around each other. And I don't even remember what the wind conditions are.
See, that's the thing. And I refuse to talk about the wind conditions because one of my favorite things that I'm attempting with Forever is to make the play become what the two players think the play should be.
Okay, yeah.
And so if two players come to the game and think, this is a competitive game, I'm trying to win, and I'm trying to make the other player lose, I want Forever to provide that for them.
Well, what was very interesting about watching people encounter this game was that they stuck with it. Even if it was incomprehensible to them, they stuck with it. And you would have the same two people sitting there grappling at each other and swinging around a little floating island in space, and just enjoying themselves and trying to figure out how the game works.
This is very satisfying for me to hear.
Well, good. I'm glad that I could provide that for you.
Yeah. No, I'm glad. It's good for me to be reminded that I have started to make this thing and that I should keep making it.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, we're all beings of finite time, and
right.
You know, it's good to have these touchstones every once in a while to say, yes, do this thing eventually when you have time to do it.
Yeah.
Because right now my life is just banana chalice.
I'm going to move this piece of paper because if you were hearing it crumple, that is a cat. We are not, in fact, on fire.
No, it's my lovely cat, Tetris, who has taken it upon herself to rub her face against the paper as much as possible.
So the thing about games like Fjords Forever, which I really appreciate, these games that have emergent cooperative gameplay like that, is that they express the purity of what makes a sport fun. And for me, I don't think it's the competition. I don't think it's the leaderboards or whatever that makes sport fun. I think it's just engaging with a human, another human, with a distinct set of rules, right?
Yeah.
You both have the same set of rules. And then you find out how to relate to that human through these sets of rules.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that if sports were only fun if you won, then there's a large portion of the sport that's wasted time, where you're spending it not winning.
Well, there are some people who enjoy that to some extent, but there's actually been a lot of research on social comparison like that, and leaderboards, Olympic athletes, and happiness levels, and it turns out that getting a gold medal does not necessarily make you the happiest Olympic athlete. It's getting a silver medal. Silver medalists are way more happy than gold medalists, mostly probably because they have something still to strive for.
That's interesting.
So I worked on a game called Bejeweled Blitz for a while, and that game is entirely leaderboard focused. It's hyper competitive in its sort of thesis statement, right?
Yeah.
And when I got onto the project, that was the attitude. It was these people that play the game, they're just really competitive, and they're focused on this leaderboard, and they just want to climb the leaderboard. And as I started unpacking it as a user experience designer, I did a lot of research, and I started unpacking it, and I started looking into social comparison theory and applying it to our population of players. And it turned out that they weren't actually competitive with the leaderboard. They were mostly competitive with themselves first to become better players. And two, second, they were competitive with maybe two or three people in their friend group that were around the same skill level.
This jives with my experience with iPhone games as well.
Yeah.
That's mostly the people that I am actually chasing scores of are, well, it's Scott Teason mostly. he seems to beat me at pretty much every game that I attempt to play. And other people that I'm friends in real life with.
Yeah.
Close internet friends with.
Well, see, that's important. You need some sort of context to be able to actually become a better player, right?
Right.
You need to have a metric of some sort. You need to be able to compare yourself against somebody on some sort of level and understand how to get better based on that comparison. If it's just a number, if it's just you look at the global leaderboards that you have in Xbox games or whatever, and you look at the very top player and their ridiculous score, there's no way you can even imagine on how to get to that level, right?
Totally.
It really is a ladder.
Cheating. I'm just they cheated.
Most of the time, that's true.
this person isn't so much better than me because they're a cheater.
The majority of the time, that is absolutely true. If you look at any of the Game Center leaderboards, it's just 9999.
Well, when we play games together, I assume you're cheating too.
So. No, I am.
Yes.
I am a cheat.
I never cheat, ever. Rules exist to be followed.
It's true. But in order to become a better player in a competition, is you need to have some context to it, which is really important for playing sports games and enjoying sports games. Mm-hmm. If you don't have any context for how to get better, you tend to drop off and you tend to become demotivated. So if you were just a terrible player and you're I don't even know what to do, I'm not going to play this, I'm not going to try anymore. But if you're a terrible player and you see somebody else who is a little less terrible than you, you're like, I know Kyle doesn't suck at things.
Yeah.
I must also not suck at things because I'm like Kyle.
Yeah.
So this is reasonable.
We share this bond together.
Yeah, this is reasonable for me to think that I am not a terrible person for playing this game.
Absolutely.
For being bad at this game, rather.
Yeah, I think that I've had this experience a lot, actually, with Ian Snyder. We play a lot of competitive games together, mostly because he is working on a competitive game. It's called Batolo. It's a game of faking each other out and attempting to take the ball. It's like a game of keep away. Mm. But we've been playing a lot of tennies together by... by, is it, I think it's JW and Kitty that did Tennies.
Yeah, I think that's part of the Sports Friends pack, right?
Yeah, it was like a bonus game for the Sports Friends Kickstarter originally, and I'm not sure if I've played, like, what versions I've played, but it's basically just, it's tennis, but with dots and large squares and slightly larger squares and lines. It's very abstracted, purified tennis.
Right.
But almost all of the rules of tennis that we think of, like having to stay on your side of the court or not being able to hit the ball more than once, those are purely upheld by the players.
Yeah.
The game actually does not prevent you from hitting the ball as many times as you want on your side of the court or whatever, and it only upholds certain rules of tennis. So the experience of playing tennis is kind of exploring this possibility space where you're fighting against your expectation of the game tennis,
right,
which I really enjoy.
Like, that's interesting.
One of JW's favorite things to do in games, I have ascertained as far as it being present in Tennies and also in Hokey, which was his other sports game that he did for the most recent Fantastic Arcade, is allowing you to continue charging a shot forever, because if you hold the button down in Tennies, you'll hit it harder.
Right.
So you can just hold it down forever and then hit it with an impossible amount of computer-assisted force.
Yeah.
So that the ball, like, completely escapes the bounds of the camera and flies across the court at just an impossible speed.
Yeah. It doesn't necessarily benefit you, but you can do it.
You can do it.
Yeah.
And sometimes you can do it in such a way that you just ace the other player and it feels really good.
Yeah.
So all that is to say that Ian is way, way, way better at Tennies than I am, and maybe better at Tennies than almost any other person, because, I don't know, he approaches sports games primarily from the vantage of trying to find the most broken thing about them and exploiting that so he can win over and over again.
Well, that sounds, I think I have friends like that.
Yeah, no,
like anybody growing up who played Pikachu in Smash Brothers.
Yes.
It's just the down B lightning bolt over and over and over
Pika,
again.
Pika, Pika,
it's the
Pika,
worst.
Pika. It's wonderful. But he's actually a very charitable person because he constantly is explaining the tricks that he's doing, and because he wants somebody to compete with him. So
yes.
He's taken, like, he's helped me a lot with my Tennies play to get to better and better. I'm really enjoying saying Tennies.
Well, that's important too, is like, if you were a high level player of anything, you don't necessarily want to dominate. You want to have a challenge. You want to have somebody who is a challenge to you to exercise your own personal skills against as well. It's no fun just to completely dominate and like hold somebody down, you know, and just be at the top of the stack all the time. The people who get to the top of the stack, they get there because they have challenged themselves and they understand how to challenge themselves, and they want to have somebody who is a worthy opponent.
Yeah, the competitive rivalry, I think, is just as important to sports games as the actual game itself. Like, if you don't have anybody playing your sports game and developing those kind of rivalries, and if the game space doesn't provide the opportunity for like minute differentiation of skill so that sometimes you're winning and sometimes you're losing and it's really close and tense, it's a hard balance to nail.
Yeah.
And if the community doesn't develop around it and become really excited about competing against each other, then I don't know, the game can't exist, because the game is upheld by the players as much as it is by the computer rules that it follows.
Yeah. Like, we just finished the annual Awesome Games Done Quick charity marathon, which is a charity speedrunning marathon. I got really, really into watching these. They actually have two per year. They've got Awesome Games Done Quick and Summer Games Done Quick. It's a week-long thing, and speedrunning itself is a very distinct sport, where you have that community that is challenging itself and challenging each other in a very genial way. You know, they're very very community focused, where they're finding out new strategies and sharing them with the world because they want to unpack this game to impossible lengths. That kind of sport is very, very fascinating to me. Sports that are just kind of emergent around games that are not even sport games.
Sure. Yeah. Well, and I think that it there's like, to be a sports game, like, I mean, it, we're finding that definition, like, when we originally like started talking about sports games just mimicked real life sports.
Yep. Like NES hockey
right now. Yeah. Ice hockey is like one of my favorite sports games.
It's actually a great game.
Because it's like, it is hockey, but it also isn't, because it took the absolute minimum of rules that you needed to make hockey feel like hockey. And then it did it. So,
yep. And then it took Blades of Steel to push it one step further and add brawling.
Yes.
Which made it feel way more like hockey.
Oh, totally. But I think also that Blades of Steel is funny because the sprites are bigger in Blades of Steel.
Yeah.
And so you necessarily have, like, this is a more literal interpretation of hockey. And, like, the movement of games towards literal interpretations of real, like, real sports that existed in this physical, corporeal world. Like, that was a movement that happened for a long, long, long time.
Yeah.
And I'm excited to see things kind of going the other way, too, that we have abstract games and people attempting to develop, like, new sports specifically in the context of video games, which it speaks a little bit to communities working together to make a sport out of a video game that wasn't necessarily a sport.
Yeah, it's very interesting stuff. All right, so on Secret Best Friends Club, there is a variety of ways for you to interact with us. You can add us on Twitter. We are at Secret Best Cast. You can also send us mail to mailbag@secretbestfriendsclub.com. You can like us on Facebook as well. And we have a mailbag letter this week, our very first one, which is great. We promised that we would print out the mailbag letters. Good. We have it up right now. So here is our mailbag letter here. And Kyle is going to read it out loud.
This is from the aforementioned Scott Thiessen. Hello, Kyle and Chris. I am wondering if either of you remember the first video game you ever played and what your experience was playing it for the very first time. Love, Scott Patil Stiltskin.
I very much appreciate that you are carrying on the Weekly Geek tradition of reading literally the mailbag, because we used to do that all the time.
Oh, that's why have a mailbag if you're not going to read it exactly verbatim what it says.
So thanks, Scott, for your mail.
Thank you again. Yes, thank you very much.
Do you want to start? What do you remember the first video game?
I do remember the first. Well, I mean, what is memory really? But yep. I have a very distinct memory that I think is my first one of a video game, and it was Super Mario Brothers, so it's nothing to, like, it's not a real deep cut as far as video games go.
Yeah.
But I remember that we had just moved to Vancouver, Washington,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't know pretty much anybody because we just moved to Vancouver, Washington. I was something like 8 years old. My parents had brought us to some sort of party at somebody's house.
Yep.
And they were familiar with all of the adults and, like, chatting and doing adult things. And it was my job to interface with the other children there that were at this party.
As a child, yeah, this was your responsibility.
This was my job. And it was explained to me. It's like, your job is to go and to interact with these children. So I know I was just cast into the world of children that were already there in their house, that we're just kind of doing things. And the nice thing about this party was that normally, like, there's some sort of rumpus room.
There's always a rumpus room.
Yeah, normally that is the case. Like, you go off and you're in this room and it's this wild west of childhood.
Yeah.
And
it's like a finished basement with, like, the wood paneled television.
Totally. And that's where children are mean to you. So, yeah. And this wasn't actually happening because everybody was just playing together in this giant, like, living room, yeah, that I remember.
The original Wild Rumpus.
It might have been, like, one of those recessed living rooms, you know, where you, like, go down a step.
Yeah.
And I loved
Shag those. Carpet. It.
Absolutely.
Smelled like cigarettes.
The best. I don't remember any of the smells, which is probably why this is such a fuzzy memory for me, but I do remember the most important feature was a television that was hooked up to Super Mario Brothers.
Right. So what was the first level that was being played? What was the
It was 1-1.
1-1.
Okay. Yep.
Straight up,
1-1. And we all just sat there waiting turns to play. And it was a mix of ages. There were some, like, teenage-y sort of girls, and then there was, like, a couple kids my age, and then, like, my brother Jeff and my sister Laura, like, we're all just kind of chilling, and I got a turn, and it was really hard. Super Mario Brothers is really hard if you've never played video games before.
Yes.
And so it quickly that World 1-1 spun itself into this like really elaborate mythic proportioned level where I imagined the bottomless pits, and like it was just very visceral. Like I remember thinking of the obstacles of that level as being so much more grand than they actually were.
Yeah.
And for a long time, the first two levels of that game, that was the whole game for me.
Yeah.
Because my parents did not own a Nintendo. And so we've talked about this, that many of my childhood friend memories are me exploiting our friendship so that I had access to their Nintendo.
Yep.
Showing up maybe when they weren't home and saying, hey, is Eric home? No? Can I come in and play Nintendo anyway?
Yeah.
To my mother's chagrin.
It's hilarious because, so Kyle and I became friends maybe 3 years ago, just after discovering each other on Twitter and discovering that we lived in the same area and we were around the same age and we had children around the same age and we had similar interests.
And you are showing a piece at an Attract Mode show.
Right.
And that's where I met you.
Right. So there was that. But as we started to become closer friends, we started to realize that we actually kind of grew up in the same town.
Yes, we did.
So my story is remarkably similar. My first game that I remember playing is Super Mario Brothers. I was about 8, and I lived in Vancouver, Washington. I was at a party that my mom and dad took us to, and we were shuffled downstairs to the rumpus room where a number of kids were playing Super Mario Brothers on a CRT TV. My first encounter with Super Mario Brothers was World 1-2.
Whoa.
And I don't know if, you pointed out that what is memory before, you know, we started this conversation. It could have been, you know, a memory that I'm retconning here. It could have been just one of those memories that you just invent or whatever. But this is my first memory of a video game was 1-2, specifically the music in 1-2 and the broodiness of like the weird gray Goombas and the weird, just really creepy pits and stuff like that.
I love the space in that song, actually.
Yeah.
It's so patient. Bonnet.
It's a very patient song. Yeah, that was my first game memory too. And again, similar, I didn't have a Nintendo until like way later. Mm-hmm. And I would go to friends' houses. My parents got divorced that year. And so when my parents were dating other people or whatever, I would go to their house and, you know, the kids there would always have a Nintendo. And so I'd play games like Mega Man and Mario Brothers 2, which was just about to be released or had just been released. And so, yeah, a lot of my early game memories were like that, too.
Yeah.
It's really fascinating.
What was the first game you owned that you remember owning?
Boy and His Blob.
Ah.
That was the first one I purchased with my own money once I had my own NES. And I selected it from Toys R Us, back when Toys R Us had the cards.
Oh, yeah.
You know? Yeah. It was a little bit less expensive than the other games, and so it was within my budget. And nice. I liked the color scheme. It was like this weird periwinkle color with the mm-hmm. Boy and His Blob, like orange text. It was a terrible choice. Like, looking back, I actually really loved that game, and I love that mm-hmm. that was one of the first ones that I encountered because it was so obtuse.
Yeah.
It was made by the creator of Pitfall, and so it had, like, just that design sensibility, right? Mm-hmm. It was a terrible game. I don't know. What was the first game that you remember owning?
I see. We went down this parallel path where my parents would not get a Nintendo because right. the Nintendo was very obviously just for playing video games.
Obviously.
Yeah. So, but they they would get a personal computer, and the first personal computer that I remember us owning, my timeline's all messed up here because I have a lot of formative MS-DOS memories and learning to play shareware games on MS-DOS.
Yeah.
And so maybe Raptor Call of the Shadows is the first game that I remember being completely enamored with and obsessed with, and I played the shareware episode over and over again.
Yeah.
It's a vertical scrolling shmup for those of you that are not familiar, and you could buy upgrades for your ship in between missions.
Man, you can get a lot of time out of a shareware version of a shmup.
Oh my gosh. Well, so shareware, period. Like that, the Apogee era of shareware, that is like my gaming childhood summarized, basically. Yep. But I think the first game that I remember us out and out owning came to us on the family's Macintosh computer, which my dad had brought home, and he brought home Myst. Mm. And he was so excited about Myst. I remember him talking to me about Myst, and he said things like, this is the future, and he was convinced that cyberspace, like many of us at the time, I suppose, us, I was a child, so...
Many of us children.
Many of us humans. No, he was convinced that cyberspace would be this three-dimensional representation of space that could navigate as you would on foot.
Yeah, and like so, One More Man style.
Of course. So Myst was very much the first step in that direction.
Yeah.
And we all played it, and it was baffling.
Yeah.
And gorgeous. And I still, like, the places in Myst and the accomplishments of just getting to different places in Myst, those are some of my most formative memories of just using computers.
Yeah. Well, so thanks for your letter, Scott.
Yes, thank you.
As promised, we must now ingest your letter. We now have to eat your letter. Mm-hmm. So
I'm going to have to eat my phone. I think I just betrayed the fact that I read it off of my phone while you made paper notes.
I was trying to sell this really hard, Kyle.
I will eat this paper then.
No, now you have to eat your phone.
I'm going to eat the paper.
Okay. No, he's literally ripping it off. He ate it. He ate it.
This is awful.
This is a terrible idea. It's like that cheapo recycled IKEA paper.
I think I did this once or twice in school, mm-hmm. where I ate a piece of paper. Probably for peer pressure reasons.
Yeah, he's really doing it.
Oh.
All right, so you too can send us letters to mailbag at secretbestfriendsclub.com. Please subscribe to the podcast. You can actually subscribe to it now. And if you like us, please leave us a review as well on iTunes. Even just a star rating would be really, really great.
It's getting better.
Helps get the word out. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next time on Secret Best Friends Club.
I swallowed it.
Good job. Quite an accomplishment.